The next case is 95-1773, Donald R. Carroll versus Allied Products Corporation.
You're saying that the person who was making the adjustments to this could not control the operation of it. Someone else had to do that?
In the particular circumstance of the task at hand, that's true. The only way to cause this press to cycle was when it was at an area far from where my client was positioned in terms of a misaligned part that he was trying to extricate. He wasn't seen. The defect was that an operator could be in control of this press in the inch mode while a person was at another area trying to do a task necessary for him to complete to put this press in order so that a part could be run. Now, there was a very simple, technologically and economically feasible design alternative that was not employed, which would have eliminated entirely this risk, and in fact had been employed on a press sold 2 years before this one to GM.
We've read the facts. Why don't you go forward and give me your best argument and why you think negligent design survived the tort reform act?
Well, because the statute doesn't say it didn't. Because the legislature expressed no intention in the statute to wipe out negligence law. Says subject to, not supplanted by. To make a long story short, a remedy that previously existed as of 1912 was eliminated, and it was a fundamental right that my client had. It was taken away from him when his action was eliminated by the courts below.
Didn't we go through that issue recently in a couple of cases involving the statute of limitations? Whether or not it was a statutory action, and I remember the vote seemed to be reversed of what normally the people on the court would vote. Three of us said no, that it was not a statute of limitation, it was not a 6-year, it was not a 2-year, it was a 6-year because it wasn't a statutory action, and the majority, I think, said no. They meant to include that, and then the subsequent case, which I'd forgotten, I remember writing, well, if that's the case, now what you said in a two-year, then all the common law causes of action are available.
That's true, Your Honor. And in fact, McCullough seemed to imply otherwise, but his progeny did not. And the fact of the matter, McCullough really supports the argument here because it says this statute didn't change the common law. Well, if it didn't, then it didn't wipe out negligence. This statute did, and its purpose was to codify strict liability in tort law that the legislature perceived as disparate, as different from circuit to circuit, from district to district. To take away negligence without expressing the intent to do so is unconstitutional. That is the proposition of law that's being raised by the plaintiff here. And there is no way for the legislature to make it clear that negligence is wiped out under our argument.
Did you agree with McCullough?
No.
Why?
Because I felt that it was a statutory action, and I felt that the board decision about the dog bite statute applied. As it relates to Proposition of Law 2, which I think is critical in this case because it is something that the workers of Ohio deserve, Grameen's applies to post-statute cases in the workplace. And the reason it does is because it cogently recognizes that in the workplace, when a worker is required to use a defective machine, he or she does not act voluntarily.
This worker was, let's get back to the facts. This worker was not required to do what he did by the employer, was he?
Indeed he was.
Well, he said, I thought, didn't he testify that you should always be in direct contact with him and the other person, make sure everything is done by procedure? He knew what the danger was of putting his hand in there when he couldn't see the other person, didn't he?
He testified quite clearly that he was in direct contact. And to be precise, and to understand exactly what was happening at the moment it was, he was trying to get a mislocated cart out. He had been in direct contact from station 1 through station 8. I feel pulled here. Somebody doesn't want me to give him facts. I know you want me to.
Well, you just answer my question.
And while he was reaching in, Justice, he realized that this cart couldn't be moved unless air pins were pushed up. He had anticipated and thought that the worker on the other side of the press knew exactly what he was doing, appreciated precisely the degree of misalignment, and was going to disconnect the air hoses for that station only. Then, when he realized that the air pins were not disconnected, he thought perhaps the man lost a tool. He did not expect that man to cycle that press because he did not give the signal to do so. And quite clearly in his deposition, he indicated that that press should not be cycled unless him, on the other side of the press, away from the control panel, gave the signal. And he didn't.
That sounds like a lot of human error rather than an error of design of the machine. There could have been something there that would have been fail-safe, but if somebody didn't activate it with human error, there still would have been an accident.
Your Honor, there's a jury question on whether moving that gate up, which he had to do to get where he got,
right,
should have been airlocked. And if it was, he wouldn't have been injured, regardless of all the procedures you'd like to prescribe. When a machine can be made safe, it ought to be. And it's a jury question, not something to be decided as a matter of law, as was done in this case, at the very least. He had to move the barrier guard out of the way to get into the point of operation. If it had been interlocked, that man on the other side couldn't have cycled that press. To require him to pull a cord, which, by the way, the supervisor says on 53 and 54, he wasn't even supposed to pull, is not an appropriate safety.
Well, but he had to cycle it some, didn't he, to do it, to adjust the die?
That's exactly right.
When that...
That's exactly right. And he didn't need to be in the point of operation when it was cycled.
Well, you're
the
saying
he should have moved
the die and then got his hands out and then inch it. Is that
he
what you're
should
saying?
Have been allowed to get that misaligned part out before that man cycled that press. And the defect is that man who cycled that press couldn't see him. And because he couldn't see him, he didn't know it was an inappropriate time to cycle that press. And Vern Burns, who I deposed in Chicago, the engineer from Pearson, admitted to me that it was foreseeable to people that work on that press. It's foreseeable people will end up with their hands in the point of operation at times they shouldn't have. This is something that the press industry has known for years and years. And in the next case of this court many years ago, the fact situation was precisely that. The lady in that case didn't have her possum pullback devices on. And the court in that case held there was still a genuine issue of material fact under the benefit risk analysis, the same analysis that the court in this case declined to adopt based upon the facts before. So, to get back to Fermin's and its application, which I think is critical, when a worker in Ohio has to encounter a risk inherent in the design of a product in the workplace, that worker is not acting voluntarily as a matter of law. And when the legislature passed the assumption of the risk statute in connection with the product liability statute 2307.71, it is presumed that the legislature meant for the elements of that affirmative defense to apply. And those elements are not met anymore in the workplace post Fermin.
I have to tell you, Counselor, I wrote Fermin, spent a lot of time on it, and I didn't think when I read this case that it had any real applicability. Fermin is really tied to an intentional tort concept as opposed to a product liability. And if you're saying that it has to arise in the workplace every time under a Fermin fact situation, then you're making the product liability statute, I think, dependent on that, and it shouldn't be.
Actually, Cremine, Your Honor, with all due respect, was a product liability case.
Yeah.
It involved the lack of an overhead cage on a front-end loader.
Well, not lack. It was removed by the employer.
My understanding, reading the facts, is that indeed the case was against the product manufacturer who offered the overhead cage to the employer, and the employer didn't buy it. And you know,
that's correct.
In a plurality opinion, joined in by Justice Asher Sweeney, that in that case, against that manufacturer who had no control over the activities of that worker in the workplace, that worker who understood that there was no overhead protection and appreciated the hazard associated with driving that vehicle into that sidewalk, and that there could be cave-ins of the fertilizer, even though I understood all of that, you decided, in your opinion, that you could not have voluntarily combat no danger under these circumstances. No different than the employer in this case, Rural People, who bought a press that failed to have an interlock barrier guard on it, and my client was required to work with that press.
But why doesn't that just stand independently on its own as a product liability case?
It does.
Okay.
It certainly does.
That was my problem trying to, because in Fermin's case, what had happened is there was a bill of lading or a sale bill, as I remember, that specifically had written on it, take the top off.
Right.
Isn't that right?
They never got delivered.
Yeah.
They never got delivered.
Well, don't take the top off, don't put it on, okay? That's what they said. Now, certainly the employee had to encounter that. But here you have a machine that allegedly is basically defective, whether or not he had to encounter it on his everyday activity. He just happened to be there in the workplace and had to encounter it there.
That's true. He had to encounter it.
So it's a separate cause of action, isn't it?
Well, indeed it is.
Okay.
Indeed it is.
A separate legal theory altogether. Okay.
Question about
what legal theory is that? Is separate?
Excuse me.
What are you agreeing to? What is the separate legal theory?
That there's a product liability claim that inures to the benefit of my client based upon the fact that press lacked an essential safety device.
Separate from what other claims?
Separate, distinct from any discussion of whether there was assumption of the risk or contributory negligence, or for that matter, common law negligence.
Separate from some other claim, and I didn't get it.
Like I said, it's separate from a negligence claim as well.
Mm-hmm.
The consideration of Duandis versus Cardi of assumption of risk. That's the remedy that he was applying.
You have less than 2 minutes left, Mr. Alcott, if you want to save any time.
The Equal Protection Clause is violated here as well. If this statute is construed to eliminate a claim for negligence, because then all victims of conduct or all victims of defective products that go there to find the statute are treated differently than victims of any other conduct of any other tort case. And as such, there must be a compelling governmental interest to justify that classification, which does not exist here. I will await for my rebuttal to proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Alcott. Mr. Moore.
Multiple safety devices on it. did not have the one thing that Mr. Alkire now says it should have had on. It's a question, I guess, of fundamental fairness, because if this court adopts Mr. Alkire's argument, only in the case of employees will assumption of the risk not be available to manufacturers. I think Justice Brown said it in his concurrence. When he said, in employment situations, there will be cases where the employee has elected to use a defective product, and those where the use of a defective product has been forced upon the employee by the economic necessity. In the first instance, assumption of the risk should remain a defense, and the latter it should not. There was no requirement in this case that Don Carroll reach into the press. He wasn't forced to do so. It wasn't part of his job. He wasn't supposed to do so.
But he was forced to use that machine. There weren't any other machines there for him to use.
Justice Douglas, that's true. But if this court holds that the requirement of using a particular machine creates an economic necessity on the employee, an assumption of the risk as a matter of policy will not exist anywhere in the employment environment, as you suggested in your plurality opinion for Means.
Do you think for Means is really applicable here? What about the separate independent cause of action of a product liability case, negligent design?
Glad you brought that up. This is a difficult issue for me, Your Honor, because as anybody who tries cases knows, and Mr. Alkire knows, and anybody who's been trial case, negligence is a more difficult thing to prove than strict liability. Strict liability favors the plaintiff. Mr. Alkire is asking this court to say that it's unconstitutional or that the negligence claim somehow survived the product liability statute. And is asking this court to say, yes, you can have a more difficult test to establish a right to recovery than the legislature gave you in the statute. I just don't see, in the statutory scheme, Justice Douglas, I don't see negligence surviving. I don't see any basis for the legislature to read. And we talked about it in the briefs section. If you compare 230771M and you read in 230773 and then you read it, it doesn't seem there was anything left there.
Good counsel, could you take us back prior to the enactment of the statute? Let's assume you don't have a statute at all, so you have a panoply of common law rights, strict liability rights. Did also this common law right exist at that time? In other words, if this had occurred prior to the statute, whether or not they might have brought the more difficult cause of action, would there have been an opportunity to bring both?
Sure. Negligence existed. This court has decided that.
So it was there as a practical matter.
Yes.
It was not used very often because it was a more difficult standard.
Well, Your Honor, also, and this is a point that this court ought to be aware of, I just thought of it, if we go all the way back to Temple versus Wynn United in this, this court held in Temple that the compliance by the manufacturer or the compliance of the product of the ANSI standard as a matter of law held not negligible. That's what Temple held. In this case, there is no issue. This product complied with the ANSI standard. Even if this court said yes, in this particular case, negligence survives somehow, Mr. Carroll's going to lose because this product met every standard at the time it was manufactured.
Well, what I want to focus on is the legal issue here.
Sure.
Of what the statute did. I thought the purpose of the statute was to codify common law, not to change it, but to simply codify the common law with respect to products liability claims, the strict liability kinds of claims, that was what was achieved with that enactment.
If you read the statute, as I read it, in fact, negligence concepts are interwoven inextricably in the statute itself, particularly in the warning section, but even in the section regarding defect. It seems to me that the legislature subsumed the negligence concepts in the act. And additionally, also, as I said, you said, Your Honor,
is there any express indication of that in the statutory enactment?
Because it doesn't say
I thought the focus of the statute was on those circumstances where you had the strict liability and simply
it doesn't seem to me, Your Honor,
codified what was the existing, what was perceived to be the existing state of case law at the time.
Well, let me just put it this way. I don't think if you read the entire statute that you can say that anything survived outside of the statute in terms of what an injured plaintiff could bring in the course of state law.
Is there any express statement of that?
There's no statement that says, we hereby state that negligence doesn't survive anymore. There's no statement specifically in the statute of that.
So if you take that position, it becomes a statutory cause of action. Any cause of action brought for product liability, non-product liability, is a statutory cause of action.
And must be brought within the parameters 23,
okay.
07, 17.
But for purposes of statute of limitations, if you know where I'm going with that, you want to just answer it. The call is wrong, isn't it? Otherwise, your argument fails.
My feeling about this is that of course, we didn't brief this specifically, but my feeling about it is that the statute of limitations issue is somewhat distinct in the sense that, and now I'm talking off the top of my head, but there did exist. The statutory scheme codifies to a great extent what did exist before. And
that was just
going back to the books. I don't want to discuss with this court my perceptions about the justice or lack thereof decision. One last point, if I might. What Mr. Alkire didn't discuss in his oral argument to this court, but which is inherent in the entire brief in terms of the assumption of the risk of the negligence claim, is that he's asking this court to state that negligence does exist as a right of action for the plaintiff. Then he says, however, because assumption of risk in the employment context doesn't exist, that's the second, doesn't exist. And since assumption is merged into comparative into contributory negligence, therefore, not only does the manufacturer who is sued both in strict liability and negligence not have a right to assert the defense of assumption of risk, the manufacturer doesn't have the right to assert the defense of contributory negligence either. And that's what I meant by fundamental fairness when we started this discussion.
What would it be in your fundamental fairness test? Fair to conclude that the statute does not specifically deal with, and therefore we assume negligence causes as they existed prior to the enactment of the statute still exist, but to apply assumption of the risk?
Well, at that point, Your Honor, then you're certainly confronted with 23-15-19, which says that contributory negligence does not apply to products liability claim.
But you could still have comparative.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. If contributory negligence doesn't apply, then you have to also deal with 23-15-19. And suddenly you're not just dealing, and I think that's the other issue so important in what the legislature was doing. When the legislature says, hey, better position than others.
They didn't say comparative negligence implied. They said contributory negligence, didn't they?
Correct, Your Honor.
You said comparative. You meant contributory.
Yes, I meant contributory. I apologize for that. But
no, I just want to be sure I understand your argument.
Right. I think the problem is that when the legislature got in and did what it did, it intended, and I think just as a matter of logistics, to cover the whole field.
Well, but it seems to me if you recognize a common law right that wasn't folded in, then the rest of the common law goes with that in terms of defenses and all of that.
Well, it's...
That gets you to your... That answers your fairness issue.
It certainly would be creating something that was ex-statutory, certainly. And I think it would be, in essence, abrogating the intent of the statute and the reach of the statute itself. But certainly there are arguments on both sides of this issue. However, I think that by reading the statute itself, it tells you where they want to go. Certainly, though, if this court says, well, negligence does apply, then the manufacturer must have the right to assert contributory negligence. And then, does that become an absolute defense? Is it a comparative defense? Where is it? I don't know. Unfortunately, for Mr. Carroll, and I think we go back to assumption of the risk. If the assumption of the risk doesn't apply in this context, if we go back to this court's last real issue, Benjamin versus Devin Reynolds, we see that Mr. Carroll's conduct was in the assumption of the risk. And that on that basis alone, the trial court's judgment must stand. Because as I said before, if there was not an assumption of the risk in this case, there can be no assumption of the risk in any case as a matter of law. And I don't believe this court's decision stands for that proposition. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Alcar, you saved 7 seconds, but take 30. Take 37.
The defect wasn't that Carroll couldn't see the operator. The defect was the man standing at the operator panel that had control of whether it was Prescott's item who couldn't see Carroll. The facts of this case are that the procedure was Carroll had a situation with the other man that he wouldn't operate the press until he got a signal from Carroll. So until Carroll gave a signal, he wasn't assuming the risk of anything. He didn't.
Isn't that why the company policy requires people to see each other in all high school?
It's not the company policy. Mr. Carroll expressed in his deposition what his procedure was. His procedure was to have contact. He said he did. He couldn't keep his eyes on the man at all times when he's working on the fingers and the part.
Didn't you say, Mr. Alcott, that he actually, talking about assumptions, that he made a couple assumptions? I can't see him because he's going to disconnect, and then I can't see him because he went to get. I'm assuming he went to get a tool. So Mr. Carroll, can you just tell us those are the thoughts that went through Mr. Carroll's mind?
Mr. Carroll's thoughts are well set forth in his deposition and do set forth what his thinking was. And his thinking wasn't that he was voluntarily or confident by any stretch of the imagination, or he wouldn't have been where he was. In this press recital, because the operator couldn't see him. And the manufacturer knew that when the press left his hands. And the manufacturer also knew, because it's applied on the same kind of press 2 years before that, that the best way to deal with that situation is the interlock barrier there. So when it's up, so that you can have access to the point of operation, you can't cycle. That was the press. And the one thing that wasn't mentioned by Mr. Moore in this situation,
very quickly, your time
was
up.
On summary judgment. Mr. Carroll is supposed to jury decide whether his assumption of the risk outweighs the defects inherent inside of his press.
Thank you. Thank you, Shalkar. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.